Welcome back to part two of Julia Roberts, the good, the bad, and the crazy. I'm Brian.
I'm Sean.
Sean, you're an English teacher.
Former
English teacher.
But I dabble.
Yes. So we know that when a verb is in its infinitive form or its imperative form, they have different meanings, but they're usually the same word in English, right? Like if I tell you to sit, but I also say sit.
Yes.
It's the same.
Yeah, same word.
So I could also tell you, Sean, eat.
Yes.
Sean, pray.
Uh-huh.
Sean, love.
That one's harder.
It's very hard. And no one finds those commands harder than Julia Roberts in the film from 2010, directed by Ryan Murphy, that we have inflicted upon ourselves.
And now you.
Just now. Sean, Julia Roberts has made many bad movies. Okay. She's made many movies, period. She's been a movie star for decades and decades. We've talked about some of her classics in the last episode. We've talked about some of her stinkers. We thought maybe we'd go down the road of Mary Riley, The Mexican. I'm sure there were many other choices. But this movie, it was imperative that we pick this as the bad film that we dissect today. Do you want to tell us why?
Because it is one of the most disgusting, repugnant films ever made. It epitomizes the worst aspects of Western civilization. It is elitist. It is orientalist. It is selfish and self-important. It is boring. It is long. It is uninteresting. It is stupid. And I hate it. I hate this film. Okay. I hate this film. It is worse than Sex and the City 2. Because at least in Sex and the City 2, you get Samantha, you know?
Now, Sean, the word you have used to describe Sex and the City 2 in the past is repugnant.
Yes, and this is in the same bracket. I'll tell you now, and dear listeners, one day I have always wanted to teach a film module anywhere. I don't care where it is.
I'll teach somewhere. It on the street.
I'll teach it on the street if I have to. And it's called Cinema of Repugnance, okay? And it is an anti-Western civilization, anti-capitalist Western civilization film module, of which the required text, the required film, is Sex and the City 2.
And now?
And, well, this is definitely on the syllabus. You'll have to do an essay about Sex and the City 2.
Mm-hmm.
But this will be one of the optional ones for the exam.
Eat, Pray, Love.
Eat, Pray, Love.
Okay.
It is disgusting.
Okay. Sean, a question. I have actually seen Eat, Pray, Love when it came out in 2010. You had not seen it. I know you expected to dislike it. Did you expect to dislike it with this much vehemence?
Yes, but I'm also annoyed that it was so boring as well. I'm angry and disappointed at every European person who appeared in this film. And, you know,
what about American people?
They just don't know any better, Brian. I'm sorry, your people don't know any better.
Well, let's just run through, because this movie has a lot of big-name talent attached to it. It's not just Julia Roberts, yeah? It also has in it several Oscar nominees, to wit, Richard Jenkins,
mm-hmm.
Javier Bardem,
mm-hmm.
James Franco, and Viola Davis. All of them are either Oscar nominees or Oscar winners. They're there with Julia Roberts, yeah? It also has a couple of memorable character actors bringing up the rear. Billy Crudup. Even Emma Thompson's sister, Sophie Thompson, pops up at one point.
The only good thing about the film.
Yeah, so this is a quite starry cast, yeah? At the service of a book that was a massive, months-long, maybe even years-long, bestseller on the New York Times bestseller
88
list.
Weeks, Brian.
88 weeks
in the top 10.
Goodness gracious. In which years? We're talking like 2007, 8, 9, presumably.
I'm guessing before the financial crash.
Okay. So this movie presumably was big. It was hotly anticipated. And it was given into the hands of a writer-director who was not the cultural force that we know him to be now. That person is gay maestro of the airwaves.
Gay industrialist. Gay factory owner. Ryan Murphy.
Ryan Murphy. Now, It's hard to remember a time when Ryan Murphy only was known for a few things, but back in the mid-2000s, he was known first as the person who'd created, you know, semi-cult television show Nip Tuck, and then who broke big with Glee. Both of those things, Nip Tuck and Glee, it was, you know, I think perfectly fine to think, this guy's got a vision, he's a gay man, he's got a kind of camp sensibility, right? Mm-hmm, like, mm-hmm. The early seasons of Glee, I watched it, I enjoyed it.
I didn't, I hated it.
You hated it?
I hated it.
I liked the fact that it was a musical, it was campy, it had, like, diverse representation, no?
I didn't like their singing voices.
Okay, well, that's your issue with contemporary vocal.
I think everybody on Broadway sounds the same at the moment. Every woman who sings is incredibly girlish.
Yes, you've made that case before, but let's be honest, like, a television musical show set in a high school with gay characters and disabled characters and people of all different rainbow races and Jane Lynch as a kind of evil lesbian, let's be honest, there was a lot to admire about Glee.
Sure there was.
So Ryan Murphy is now culturally dominant.
Yes.
Every single anthology, horror series, crime show, you know, feud, all this kind of stuff, it's like chock-a-block full of our eyeballs. He's bringing Boys in the Band back to Broadway. He's doing everything.
Yeah, so this is where my issue with Ryan Murphy kind of zigzags. Because I actually think that the American Horror Stories are great. You and I loved The People vs. O.J. Simpson.
Yeah.
We have not watched The Versace Show, although I hear a lot of people who do actually like it for various reasons. I mean, I have not seen The Normal Heart. You have. And bringing Boys to the Band to Broadway is not a bad thing. So, like, he's definitely a force for good, and he's just signed a $300 million deal with Netflix. So he is going to create content that has LGBT characters, diverse characters, all these things that I am totally 100% fine with.
And I believe when we talk about LGBT content, doesn't that Netflix deal include a television series that's going to star Barbara Streisand?
It does?
Yep, Barbara and Gwyneth Paltrow, I believe.
Are you kidding me?
I think I've got that right. In a political drama with the lead played by Ben Platt from Dear Evan Hansen.
You're kidding me?
That's about as gay as it gets.
Oh my god.
So Ryan pushes some of our buttons for sure, even if we hate him as well.
Well, Gwyneth Paltrow. I mean, you can't win them all, can you?
Can I just say, Barbara and Gwyneth as mother and daughter is kind of perfect. I mean, in the sense of, like, complete self-absorption meets complete self-absorption. It probably will create a black hole that will suck everything else.
Well, what will happen is they'll just cancel each other out. So when it's like, you know, when you put two magnets together, they just kind of repel each other. So they'll actually never be able to film a scene together.
So, in many ways, as we talk about this, about the self-absorption and all of that, Ryan Murphy maybe seems like the right person to make a film of Eat, Pray, Love? I'm not sure. I think it's really interesting that he is, like, up there with the most powerful players in Hollywood when it comes to television, right? Like, there's Shonda Rhimes, there's him. Mm. They don't just have one show, they have kind of a whole type of show, they have a whole empire of shows, yeah? But Eat, Pray, Love is really his biggest entree into the world of feature filmmaking, and it was not very well received. Although he did continue his relationship with Julia Roberts, yeah. Because obviously she appeared in The Normal Heart.
Yes.
You know who originally wanted to play that role of the doctor in The Normal Heart?
Yes, I believe it was a director.
She was hoping to direct it and appear in it herself, and she optioned the rights from Larry Kramer for decades and left the man hanging.
Well, you know what? Larry Kramer always thought this woman was completely nuts.
It is. Why didn't Barbara Streisand make The Normal Heart? Like, honestly, if she wanted an Oscar, don't you think she should have made The Normal Heart, like, sometime in the mid-90s?
Well, you know, you and I were talking about this off mic the other day, is that, you know, even in the 1990s, with Hurt Loud and her appeal and her financing of things. Maybe they weren't ready for an AIDS movie starring Barbara Streisand. I don't know.
And a bunch of gay men. I guess not.
I don't know. Like, it's more complicated than you probably want to admit.
But Larry Kramer is on record as saying he's really pissed off that she, like, hung on to the rights for so many years and then made The Mirror Has Two Faces instead.
Well, that gave us I Finally Found Someone.
I would like to have seen what Barbara did with The Normal Heart, I have to say.
She would have made herself the person dying of AIDS.
I just hope she wouldn't have cast Jason Gould in one of the lead roles. Actually, she probably would have.
Back to
a different type of repugnance. Now, Sean, Eat, Pray, Love is based on a book, as we've said, by a woman named Elizabeth Gilbert. I think, well, let's see, 2010 was the first full year that I lived in the UK after moving here from New York City. So I would have been in America when Eat, Pray, Love was making the rounds, when it was in every book club, when it was on Oprah. I certainly saw it being read by dozens of people, let's be honest, primarily women, on the New York City subway. Did the book or the words Eat, Pray, Love have any meaning for you? Was this something that registered with you at all?
I never heard of the book until I heard of the film. In 2010, I was really busy reading Roland Barthes, so I can't exactly say I noticed this paperback piece of shit in the local W.H. Smith.
I see.
Next to the food, the indignity of having to eat at W.H. Smith. So while I was enjoying the death of the author, I was watching the death of literature itself be sold from bookstore to bookstore in train station and airport lounge across the universe.
This is not really literature. This is non-fiction, ostensibly. This is a memoir by a working sort of journalist or columnist, this woman Elizabeth Gilbert. She was a travel writer or a features writer, you know. She wasn't all that well known, and something about this book touched a nerve. I have to say that after we watched the movie recently, I did look up some, like, Elizabeth Gilbert herself, just to see, like, who she is and what she's like, because she's been phenomenally successful.
Yeah.
Since the publication and success of Eat, Pray, Love, she's given dozens of, like, TED Talks and, like, Oprah interviews trying to explain, like, what it is about Eat, Pray, Love that connected with so many people.
There's a certain randomness in the way that my questions, for some reason, about my life intersected, dovetailed with questions that apparently a lot of other people, women in particular, at this moment in history were asking about their lives. One possible answer is, I mean, I do feel like I'm a pretty representative example of my culture. You know, I'm pretty representative 21st century middle-aged American woman.
Is Elizabeth Gilbert a representative American woman?
Well, let's just see what she has going for her, okay? She's white, she's female, she's educated, she is privileged.
How is she privileged? What does she do?
Well, she does not labor. She writes for the New York Times as a living, you know?
Okay, I'm just gonna pause there. Writing articles for a newspaper is indeed labor.
Listen, Maggie Haberman, okay, love her.
Yeah.
Okay, you know, she's a trailblazer. Keep going, Maggie. If you're writing the travel section of the New York Times, you are laughing, okay? You are on cloud 9 and you're hopping on to cloud 10, okay? You do not toil. You do not sweat. You have never seen a steel mill, okay? You know,
so it's only steel mills or junkets and mini bars. Those are the only two.
Well, this is what, you know, polarized America would like you to
think. Darling, you've got to write things that people want to read. You've got to turn in your words. Like, it is work.
Listen, okay, I know it's work, okay? I'm not against fantasy or escapism or any kind of that.
Yeah.
I like travel writing to a certain degree, okay? What we found out about this book is that she proposed this book to her publisher before she took any of the trips, okay?
She was paid
to have this journey of self-discovery, okay? And to preach to people, okay? You do not get that.
And I've always wondered this about book proposals. It's like, if you propose to your editor, I'm going to go on a journey of self-discovery, pay me to do this. Like, what if you don't discover anything? Your book is like, I went off on this journey.
Eat, Pray, Fail, you know? Which I think would have been a much more interesting book.
We also learned from Wikipedia that the relationship that she then finds at the end of Eat, Pray, Love only lasted for a while, and then and then ended.
Well, this becomes much more interesting.
Yeah, maybe we'll get to that at the end of the podcast.
All right, so let's talk about Julia fucking Roberts.
Okay, Julia fucking Roberts. Well, here's my question, Sean. Someone made the decision. They thought, this book is hugely popular. It's in every suburban women's book club. It's really connecting with people, whether we think that this privileged white journalist on a junket of self-discovery is representative or not. Clearly, some people related to it. I mean, they probably related to it because they wanted to go on this journey, and they could do it with her in the book,
yeah,
right?
But that's the thing about writing, is that it takes you somewhere.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's a self-help book. It's a self-help memoir, right? But some movie executive decided it would be worth turning into a movie. They got Ryan Murphy and another screenwriter to adapt it and direct it. They got this cast together.
Didn't David Mamet do the screenplay?
No, I can only imagine if he did.
I wish he did.
Oh my God. The only thing that would make it more worthy of your reprehensible syllabus is if David Mamet threw in a bit of neocon militarism in there, which he's wont to do. Mm. Luckily, we were spared that. So, Sean, here's my question. Could Eat, Pray, Love make a good movie ever in any way?
Well, you know I'm going to say no.
It's an interesting thought experiment. Like, is this project doomed from the start? Should a self-help memoir ever become a film?
Okay, well, let's talk about the things that lead up to the creation of this book, okay? So first of all, you're supposed to think that this person is living a terrible life, okay? So what's so terrible about her life, Brian? Let's go.
Well, she's in a marriage to Billy Crudup.
Mm-hmm. Could do worse.
She seems to be regularly employed by, you know, journalistic outfits that send her around the world to write about things. She goes to Bali, she comes back, but she somehow seems, like, disassociated from herself, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, Billy Crudup, it's never really clear what's kind of wrong with him. Like, he's cute.
There's nothing wrong with him,
he's
Brian.
Cute, he's a nice guy. He's sort of wandering himself, he's kind of searching for things. At one point he says he wants to be a pastry chef. He's thinking about returning to school to be a teacher.
That's it, okay, this is it. If you are in a privileged marriage, okay, where you have lots of shit in your house that's very expensive, okay?
Yeah.
If I turned to you and said, Brian, you know what? You and I are so blessed that I want to be a teacher to get into our public school system and make a difference. You would say, Sean, I'm so proud of you.
If you've done, like, several different careers, I might be like, how long are you going to stick with this one?
Well, I'm going to study for it, at least.
Yeah.
And you'd say, you know what? I support you on this. You wouldn't be like, oh my God, my marriage is doomed, okay?
It has to admit, a long section of this movie, like the first, like, 20 minutes, are sort of set up in this way that's going to, like, propel our heroine, Liz Gilbert, off on this journey. And you're just kind of like, I'm not quite sure what's so bad about her life, except for her.
Yes.
Like, so first of all, she's surrounded by cute guys, right? Yep. She's with Billy Crudup, and then she ends up with James Franco for a while as well. She's also surrounded by, like, the wittiest, chicest, most amazing editor the world has ever had.
Yeah.
Viola Davis.
I mean, who wouldn't, you know?
I mean, honestly, isn't it fascinating to remember there was a time where Viola Davis had to take on roles like this?
I know, she's... Do you know what, though? She's
It wasn't
so
that
good
long ago.
I know. But she's so good. Isn't she so good?
But it's just... It's fascinating to me that, like, we saw her in a thankless role in Out of Sight. She's, like, Julianne Moore's maid in Far From Heaven. She's, like, this, like, nameless editor in this. She also has, like, a nameless, thankless role in Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close. Thank God Viola Davis has catapulted into stronger leading roles.
Well, I wish the same could be said for Sally Kirkland.
If only Sally Kirkland had been in this.
Justice for Sally.
Then the movie could have been good. What if it had been a journey of self-discovery with Sally?
Well, Sally is a guru, you know, and a healer. Although there were no women in any clinics that we saw, so there weren't any really roles for Sally.
Okay, so Julia Roberts is having a vaguely defined tough time in her marriage. She wants to get divorced. Now, here is where I really related to Billy Crudup. Like, she really presents no reason why she wants to get divorced from him. And he wants to stay together. And she's like, you know what? You've got all these ideas. Why don't you just pick one dream and stick with it? And he says, okay, I pick you.
Yeah.
He's like, we made vows. Now, granted, anyone should be able to dissolve their marriage, you know, when they want to. But, like, if they have got together, like, you would think there needs to be a stronger reason for it. Like, I don't know. It really paints her in a bad light. An even worse light is how she ends up with James Franco, who, let's admit, is the world's most reprehensible human being. Not just in this film, but just generally.
Mm.
Yeah?
Now all these, you know, horrible allegations against him, which have just... Which I you know, have to trust the women who've made these comments against him. Like, he is such a creep.
How does Julia run into him? He's an actor who's performing in a play that she's written, which has a very memorable title.
This is where I think, at this point in the film, I was like, oh, the film's a parody. It's a parody of things. I can get on board with this, okay? The play he's in is called Permeable Membrane, okay? And at one point in this 2-minute scene, the girl says, it's as if I'm living in a permeable membrane. And I'm like, where's my shot glass, Brian? I left it around here somewhere.
So I think we're meant to think Liz is so bad and so disassociated from herself that she's written a really bad play, which out-of-work actor and yoga enthusiast and guru follower James Franco has appeared in. They start dating. This is just yet another sign that she's gone from divorce to yet another nameless man, right? And she's kind of adopting his lifestyle, which is to be a hippie and to do meditation and all this stuff. And meanwhile,
an even bigger douchebag.
Yeah. Viola Davis is trying to talk sense into her.
I'm going to Italy.
Italy? Why Italy?
What did you have for lunch today?
I don't know. Salad?
Exactly. I used to have this appetite for food, for my life, and it is just gone. I want to go someplace where I can marvel at something. Language. Gelato, spaghetti, something.
This is, if you haven't already been lost by Liz Gilbert, you get lost here because you're like, Jesus Christ, who wouldn't like to be sent around the world to, like, find themselves through eating? Mm. I mean, that's the thing. She's going to go to Rome and she's going to eat delicious food and somehow, like, meditate on how wonderful and spiritual all this is. You're seething.
I just hate this film.
If the film had been, like, more fun, like, what if it just been, like, a woman goes to Italy and eats lots of food?
Okay, if then it was Jenny McCarthy, maybe.
Or what if it was, like, Under the Tuscan Sun or something?
I never would have seen that.
But I'm just saying, like, you don't think those movies are reprehensible because...
Carmen Electra or Jenny McCarthy in this role?
It's not Carmen Electra, it's Diane Lane.
I would like Carmen Electra in this role.
I'm just saying, if it's, like, a just kind of, like, enjoyable travel porn that's, like... Oh, the beauty of a foreign locale. Oh, delicious food. Oh, handsome men.
Yeah, but when you put wankers in those roles, and when the characters themselves are wankers, you don't get any satisfaction out of it.
Okay, the other way that it could be good, like, another movie that's based on, like, a journalistic article is Adaptation.
Yes.
So what about, like, the Charlie Kaufman version of this film, where Permeable Membrane becomes, like, this meta-parody about, like, you know...
Dimensions.
Liz Gilbert's, like, whole weird level of, like, writing about her own experience while experiencing the experience. Like, that kind of could have
been
cool.
Well, you know, I wish, like, if Charlie Kaufman was doing it, he'd be like, how do I make this person... like, likable, human, relatable. This person's despicable.
Or maybe, like, emphasize the despicableness, and then it becomes, like, Synecdoche, New York, yeah, Prey Love.
It would have been way more interesting.
Okay, yeah. But they do instead just go to Italy.
So, in Italy, okay, oh my god, I think Italians should have rioted based on this.
I like the Italy
You know what? Italians
best.
Have been complicit in a lot of terrible things,
okay,
Brian.
As an Italian, I think it's a perfectly lovely picture postcard for Italian culture. It seems very, very enjoyable. The food looks good. The men are handsome.
It makes the Italian language seem imbecilic.
What are you talking about?
Okay, there's a whole section about where they learn about the gesticulations of the Italians and the words.
You can't just speak it with your mouth. You have to use your hands.
It is just embarrassing. It's insulting.
There's literally a character named Luca Spaghetti. Luca Spaghetti.
Yeah.
Now, to be fair, her Italian tutor, the man who tutors her in Italian, is very cute.
Mm-hmm.
And they have these romantic sections where he teaches her things like, noi attraversiamo. And she says things like, oh, that's the perfect Italian word. The languid ah, the trolling, the rolling trill. You
trolling,
know?
Yeah, they are trolling, Brian. You were right the first time.
And then there's wonderful operatic montages of her slurping up spaghetti and carbonara.
And then they're like, oh, I'm getting fat. Oh, we have to go and put on our fat women jeans.
Yeah, okay. Now, who you didn't briefly just describe, she meets another woman.
She meets a Swedish woman. Who
At a coffee bar.
Yeah, as exciting as that sounds, okay? And so they go and they eat food together. And then the Swedish woman is like, a pizza gets put in front of her. And she says, I can't eat this. And I'm thinking there, fucking waste of food, first of all.
But Julia says the same.
I know.
Julia says, what do you mean you can't eat this? We're in Napoli and here's some pizza margarita. You have to eat it.
Yeah.
I'm so tired of saying no and waking up in the morning and recalling every single thing I ate the day before. Counting every calorie I consume so I know exactly how much self-loathing to take into the shower. I'm going for it. I'm no interest in being obese. I'm just through with the guilt.
Like, the whole section of the Italy thing is about enjoying pleasure, mm-hmm. right? It's like the pleasures of consumption, of eating. And also, to be honest, if you ask me one thing that I took away from the movie when I first saw it in 2010, it was the concept of dolce fa niente. Okay? For our Italian listeners, they already know what this means. But did you learn anything about dolce fa niente?
Well, I hope it's real. This is the thing. I don't believe anything about this.
What do you think it means based on how they describe it?
Well, dolce fa niente, it's like the beauty
not
of doing...
Not Vianni, niente.
What did I say?
If you said dolce fa niente.
What's that?
I don't know. It's just a word you made up. Let's get that out of there.
That's just a hint, okay? No, please. That was funny. I'm also an executive producer of this podcast.
It's just a word you made up, I think.
Okay, so no, it's not dolce fagnani. It's dolce... what? Ragu? What?
Dolce fagnani is an Italian drag queen on season 11 of RuPaul's Drag Race. Dolce fa niente.
Oh, so I was close. Dolce fa niente means the beauty of doing nothing, which I've been practicing my entire life.
Well, and as someone who has difficulty practicing that.
It's true, you do.
I do. I find it very difficult to do nothing. Like, if I'm doing nothing, I think to myself, maybe I should be editing a podcast. So I do understand how for a certain high-powered person leading a metropolitan, cosmopolitan life, the idea of saying, you know what, just... sit in your lovely pensione and have a plate of asparagus with a slice of prosciutto and an egg and do nothing.
Yeah, wear your pince-nez and enjoy life.
Your pince-nez.
Isn't that a thing?
Pince-nez.
Pince-nez,
yeah. Okay, good. So, so yeah, Julia learns this lesson. And, like, the film is annoying up until this point, but, like, you know, it's not reprehensible. Then she goes to the East, okay? So perhaps, like, exoticizing Italians for their hand gestures and their delicious food and their ability to do nothing, you know, they're still within the European spectrum of things. She arrives in India, and immediately the music changes to, like, Slumdog Millionaire, and she's in, like, an ashram, which is the guru who, James Franco has turned her on to, and she's having eaten everything. She's now going to discover through, like, prayer and meditation some kind of spiritual identity.
Yes.
What did you think about this section?
She arrives in India. Children rush up, okay, to touch her, to hold her hand. She smiles. These children are street children. She looks at the people picking rubbish off the side of the road, and she's driven to her, you know, white person hideaway, where they all chant and scrub floors for probably $1,000 a week.
And no sooner does she start scrubbing the floor than a young Indian woman comes up to her and says, help, help, Liz, I'm going to be set up in an arranged marriage and I'm not into it, you have to help
Only
me.
Only you can help me.
Only you can help me, travel writer from the New York Times.
We should actually, I want to point out earlier in an earlier scene in Italy, there's a dinner where everyone goes around the table
it's
and
a Thanksgiving
says, Thanksgiving
dinner.
Yeah. And they say, what are you thankful for? And they're like, I'm thankful for Liz. Okay? So this appalling thread, this shit brown thread, is going through this whole tapestry.
That every person she meets is thankful for her, but she's thankful for them in return.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, so she meets this girl who's not happy about the arranged marriage. She also runs into Richard Jenkins.
Yeah.
By this point, Oscar nominee Richard Jenkins, I believe, for his role in The Visitor, acclaimed character actor, also nominated this past year for The Shape of Water. He's a very disagreeable character who kind of exists to, like, taunt her, yeah? In some ways, Sean, Richard Jenkins' character voices a lot of the critiques that you have of Liz Gilbert in the film, right? He's kind of saying, you're just here, you're not emptying your mind, you're not really engaging in true spiritual discovery, you're just, like, here fixated on trivial things about your failed relationships and your life and all this kind of stuff. You don't know any real pain.
You know, if you could clear out all that space in your mind that you're using to obsess over this guy and your failed marriage, you'd have a vacuum with a doorway. And you know what the universe would do with that doorway? Rush in. God, rush in. Fill you with more love than you ever dreamed of. Man.
She tells him at one point, has anyone ever told you that everything you say sounds like it comes off of a bumper sticker?
Yeah, which is a direct line lifted from Postcards from the Edge.
Yes, from the great late Carrie Fisher.
That made me very angry.
Yes. Are you going to have a suit against Ryan Murphy now that Olivia de Havilland has been thrown out of court?
If I was in a suit against Ryan Murphy, he'd probably want to come all over it.
So... do you want to just quickly whiz through...
That's pretty gross.
Yeah, it is. Do you want to quickly whiz through what happens with Julia and Richard Jenkins?
Well, first of all, she convinces this young girl to have her arranged marriage. That goes ahead.
And we kind of watch it with all its kind of orientalist, exotic glory. I mean, it makes the best exotic Marigold Hotel look restrained in terms of the, like, bright colors and the, like, floating petals and henna tattoos and everything.
Yeah.
And Julia and Richard are there, and in the voiceover, Julia says something like, going to someone else's marriage always makes you think of yourself.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, maybe it does for you, Liz Gilbert.
Yeah. So they have a heart-to-heart in which he tells her that he had a wife who died. Is that right?
Well, what he basically tells her in a harrowing monologue, which you seem to have forgotten, Sean, is that he was a horrible alcoholic who destroyed his entire life, lost his job, and nearly ran over his 8-year-old son in a car, at which point his wife left him and took the children away, and he escaped to India to try and, like, escape all this pain. So Richard Jenkins has real pain, and it's clear to me that, like, Ryan Murphy thought Richard Jenkins might get some kind of, like, Best Supporting Oscar nomination for this, because, like, that monologue is filmed like an Oscar clip.
Yeah,
it comes out of nowhere. He says this, she realizes, okay, this is why he's been so disagreeable, he has real pain, she meets an elephant. Somehow this whole experience allows her to, like, purge and release all of her emotional pain, and we have, like, flashbacks with her and James Franco, flashbacks with her and her marriage to Billy Crudup.
You don't care anymore, or less.
And there's all these kind of platitudes about, like, if you think about the people who've wounded you in the past and the ruins, that's just what change is all about. And just send them light, send them love, and let go.
You know way too much of the dialogue of this film.
I've seen it twice, and I also took notes.
Someone has to.
Okay.
She leaves India with a whole load of banal truisms.
Yeah, exactly. And she shows up in, to be honest, the whole movie started in Bali because her first travel assignment was in Bali where she met a...
medicine man.
Yes, a medicine man. At one point in the movie, I believe Liz, the character in the film, describes this man as, quote, looking a bit like Yoda.
Yeah.
Now, how did you feel about this characterization of this man who's missing a couple of teeth and speaks in this kind of broken English where he says
it's barely broken, can I just point that out, okay? At the very start of the film, he says, you'll come back here and you'll teach me how to speak English because I've never had the opportunity to speak English with anyone. And it's like... this man doesn't need any English lessons. If she did have English lessons with Elizabeth Gilbert, she'd be like, we're going to read about me.
His big issue in speaking English is perhaps not the grammar, but the fact that he speaks in wise person from the East inflection.
Yeah. You know, I was just thinking, watching this, how many of these wanker Westerners do these poor Indonesian people have to put up with every day? You know what I mean? So basically, bombs have just gone off in Bali at this point, okay?
Well, I know.
And so she's there thinking, how do I convert my loft? You know?
Well, he gives her...
I just don't know where I'm going to put this vase.
He gives her a prophecy, right? Which is like, he's looking at her palm and he's reading her palm and he's like, you will lose all your money and then you will get it back. She comes back, and she's horrified to see that he doesn't remember her until she says, oh, you know, I'm Liz Gilbert. And he's like, ah, Liz, yes, you. When you came before, you were like a sad old lady, and now you look so happy. It's funny, I apologize if this impersonation sounds racist. It is exactly how the man talks, and the more I do it, the more he sounds like Elmo from Sesame Street.
Can I also point out, when he said he didn't recognize her, I actually got interested in the film.
You're like, oh yeah, so it's like, she's not the center of the world until...
Oh wait, no, sorry, you are.
I do remember you, and I do remember exactly what I said to this palm reading that I gave, like, over a year ago, even though I probably give it to every person who travels through Bali. So she's in Bali, it's a beautiful landscape, you know, I'm sure the Bali Tourism Bureau was happy about it. She meets someone who I generally think is very sexy.
Javier Bardem.
Yeah, Spanish stud Javier Bardem. They have a meet cute where he's driving a Jeep and he nearly runs her off the road on her bicycle. Now, Sean, did you find Javier to be sexy in this film?
I found him to be reminiscent of LaToya Jackson.
To me, it was Anna Magnani. I don't know.
You kind of had this puffiness to him, this feminine puffiness to him.
I mean, do you usually find Javier to be a stud?
I mean, you know, I like people with fucked up faces.
Yeah, I once heard someone on a podcast describing his sexiness as the sexiness of someone who looks like they've been hit in the face with a shovel. And I think that's exactly right about Javier at his sexiest. He's a Brazilian man, isn't he?
Yeah, the character is,
the character is Brazilian. Javier is doing this funny voice. I'm sure in his mind he was like, well, I could employ a dialect coach to teach me how to do an authentic Brazilian accent speaking English, or I could just do this fucked up version that I'm doing now because no American person is going to be able to tell the difference between my Spanish accent and an actual Brazilian accent. So it's like Javier Bardem, like, mushing up a few consonants every once in a while, yeah?
What are these?
These are rambutan. They're delicious. It's like like an orange made love to a plum. You like some?
Can you put it that way?
Oh, okay. Yes,
thank you. Wow.
It's beautiful.
And he has that kind of weathered look. Like, I wondered if it was a deliberate choice that he has been, like, living in Bali and out in the, like, frontier and stuff. But, yeah, it's not
just drinking really
appealing.
Strong, you know, alcohol the entire time.
He's a very sensitive man. He has children in Australia. He's divorced as well. He calls his children darling.
Yeah, he kisses them all on the lips.
Yeah, he's like...
He has a son who is clearly 30 and, like... Javier is clearly 40, and it's like, okay, so this is your son? Okay, right.
You know, one thing that Ryan Murphy, now that he's become more powerful with all his television casting, like in every single Ryan Murphy television series, he casts the hottest, hunky, young actors. In this, he doesn't really have much scope to do that, but there are a couple of exceptions. So Javier Bardem's son is reasonably hunky.
Yeah, nice arms.
Then there's this Aussie guy who Liz Gilbert, like, nearly gets with.
Come on, Liz, let's get into the water.
And he has,
we're in Bali.
He has, like, absolutely perfect abs and a gorgeous, like, Greek statue-worthy ass.
Yeah. He's a lovely ass.
Yeah. And Julia, in one of the memorable lines of the film, he, like, wants to go skinny dipping with her, and Julia says, I dated you 15 years ago, I dated you 6 years ago, so no. That's where you really learn, you know, how Liz has come to wisdom. Don't go for the abs and the ass. Go for the guy who runs an import-export business in Australia. That's really the lesson.
So have you learned your lesson yet?
I need an import-export
business. Yeah, you
do. Here's another fundamental flaw of the movie, right? Okay, it's Eat, Pray, Love. We've been through, like, an hour and 40 minutes or more before we finally meet the love interest. And so we then have to, like, establish this relationship that we're going to somehow care about between her and Javier. But by this point, we just kind of want the movie to end.
It's 2 hours and 20 minutes.
It's really long.
It's really long.
And they have to, like, go through some ups and downs. They have to draw closer. She has to be nervous about making a commitment because... You know, basically she says something along the lines of, I've finally found balance in my life. And he's like, Sometimes being in love is about allowing yourself to be out of balance. Come with me in my boat and we will sail to our own island together. And so she has to have a lot of hemming and hawing about how she's ready to do this. Meanwhile, the other plot that we've not mentioned, in addition to the medicine man, there's also this female woman who heals her at one point where she has like a urinary tract infection or something.
Does she hurt her leg, remember?
She hurts her leg, but she also has like a bladder infection. Oh. The lady says something like, when you have no sexy time for a long time and then you have sex, it hurts. Or something like that.
Mm.
This healer woman doesn't have a house because she's been a victim of domestic violence and she and her daughter don't have anywhere to live. So Liz does what any good, upstanding white person with privilege would do. She starts a Kickstarter campaign.
She gets all her rich friends to help out.
Which, to be honest, is a nice thing to do this woman.
That is true.
Conveniently, the daughter's name is Tutti. And the word tutti in Italian means everybody. So Liz has more opportunity to say a bunch of trite things like, sometimes when you go on a journey trying to help yourself, you end up helping
tutti. Can you wrap this up soon?
We can. The lady gets her house. She ends up getting with Javier. And then she gives this insanely clunky, like, final speech about the physics of the quest.
If you're brave enough to leave behind everything familiar and comforting, which can be anything from your house to bitter old resentments, and set out on a truth-seeking journey, either externally or internally, and if you are truly willing to regard everything that happens to you on that journey as a clue, and if you accept everyone you meet along the way as a teacher... And if you are prepared, most of all, to face and forgive some very difficult realities about yourself, then the truth will not be withheld from you.
Dolce far niente, the physics of the quest, let go, like all stuff. It's the kind of thing you would see on some sort of like posters that would be up in like a yoga studio. It's not the sort of thing that anyone should actually say out loud to one another in a film.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay.
And yet again, more people say, thank you, Liz. Thank you for building me a house. Thank you for helping me heal. You have helped me, Liz. You know, it's like, Liz is the best person in the world.
Before we talk about Julia, we should say, the interesting thing that happened to Liz Gilbert is that she doesn't stay. She stayed about 4 or 5 years.
In real life.
Yeah, in real life with Javier Bardem, who she then separated from and then spent the last few years with a woman who she fell in love with.
So this Balinese love that the movie ends with is only the beginning of a later chapter where she leaves the guy for a woman
who she's known for years.
And the woman dies of cancer.
Yeah, she died this year, in fact.
We only learned this from Wikipedia. I mean, do you think there's another sequel to Eat, Pray, Love on its way?
I hope not, although it would be more interesting than the shit that we've just had to watch.
Now, Sean, it is clear that we find this movie dreadful. I am of the opinion that the true test of a movie star is how they fare in really awful material.
Yeah.
Okay? I want to posit something. I think Julia Roberts, she does not save this film. She does not make it work. Yet, she is using all of her natural charisma, her winningness, her humor, her charm, her smile. She does more than nearly any other person could possibly do to make this character of Liz Gilbert seem even remotely relatable. And I think that is actually a great testament to movie star charisma. Do you agree with me?
I hear what you're saying, and I largely understand it. But I also think that Julia probably helped in getting this film made.
Oh, completely.
Yeah,
of course.
And that is actually the biggest crime of all.
Even her deciding that she wanted to be in this was bad.
But because she decided to be in it, it probably got a bigger budget.
Sure.
And it probably got Javier Bardem involved. And it probably got more people of credibility. I would have died a peaceful death with someone else in it, instead of being zombified and back constantly in people's lives with Julia Roberts in it.
Well, let's say one thing. This movie came out in 2010. Julia Roberts won her Oscar for Erin Brockovich 10 years earlier. And actually, we looked at her filmography. In those 10 years, Like, there was one big hit, which was Ocean's 11, but she's hardly the center of that movie. And there were tons of major misfires.
Yeah.
Things like Larry Crown with Tom Hanks, Charlie Wilson's War also with Tom Hanks. I think they thought this was going to be a real comeback vehicle for Julia, her entering a new phase of kind of mature womanhood. It doesn't totally work. But I have this to say, Sean. Like, when you're thinking about Eat, Pray, Love with another actress in it, I'm just going to say some words to you, okay?
Yeah, go for it.
Give me your instantaneous reaction.
Yeah.
Eat, Pray, Love with Hilary Swank.
It would have gone straight to video.
Eat, Pray, Love with Renee Zellweger.
I'm actually fine, yeah. I don't know. I'm not in the whole hating Renee thing that you are.
You know, like a litmus test, yeah, mm-hmm. in chemistry. I mean, I don't really understand what it is.
It's for acids and bases.
Thank you. I think Eat, Pray, Love should be a litmus test for actresses. If you can envision an actress in Eat, Pray, Love and it being even remotely watchable, you like that actress. Okay?
Julianne Moore
in Eat, Pray, Love.
Of course, yeah.
Mm?
Easily, yeah.
Isabelle Huppert in Eat, Pray, Love.
Okay, yeah.
Okay.
What about Julia Binoche in Eat, Pray, Love?
That's bordering on chocolat territory to me there. I don't know. The task of starring in Eat, Pray, Love should be something that every actress should be asked to do just to see if we stab out our eyes.
Jennifer Aniston in Eat, Pray, Love.
Oh my God.
I think it would have worked.
Maybe it would have worked better.
Yeah,
Who's to say? Sean, do you think less of Julia for having eaten, prayed, and loved?
I do.
But you love Julia, am I right?
Yeah, but I don't like this film.
I think you've made that entirely clear. Julia has moved on. Yeah. Let's be honest, Wonder is the kind of inspirational, not particularly challenging film Julia should be making. This is false inspiration, which really has a cynical, capitalist, bitter pill at its center.
And then this is officially the last thing.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe she should do the sequel, you know? The lesbian lover dying of cancer story.
It'd be great, particularly if the lesbian lover was Isabelle Huppert.
Yeah.
All right, please check on Twitter, where we'll be teasing the final installment of Julia Roberts' Good, Bad, Crazy. We'll be going back to a very young Julia.
Back again.
In one of her signature early roles, one you may have been sleeping on, but will be tense and thrilled to remember.
I like that, Brian. Good.
Thanks. Good, Bad, Crazy, Part 3, coming up soon.
Bye.